Welcome to the Alcohol Addiction Podcast. My name is Lee Davey. I'm not an alcoholic. I refuse to be anonymous. I'm someone that doesn't drink alcohol. And I spend every waking moment of my life helping other people do the same. Like right now, folks. Before we get to today's podcast, which I'm going to try and run through as quickly as I can. I've got a lot to talk about today, but I do have a wife and child who are going to come bounding through that door any moment now. I'm going to be disrupting me and screaming in my ear and wanting my love. So let's hope we can get there the end before they arrive, as much as I love them dearly. I love you all too. So let's just start with some introductions. I want to say welcome to Strive to Susie. Susie has recently joined. I believe she used to be part of the Annie Grace community. It maybe still is part of the Annie Grace community. And I like that. It goes to show that people don't need to spend their time in one place. I know, for example, most of our course drivers, they spend their time hanging around with Annie. They spend their time hanging around with Belle. They spend their time hanging around with Andy over at One You Know Beer. I think that's really important. Don't keep all your eggs in one basket, because if that basket drops, they all get cracked, right? So, you know, pick up all the best bits you can get off different people. And there are never been more resources on how to be someone that doesn't drink alcohol than there is today. So have a little drink of my peppermint tea from my Shanghai Starbucks cup. I want to say a big well done to Holly, to Duncan, to Tony, to Kim, and to Glynis. Look, you lovely quintet. I know this journey to be someone that doesn't drink alcohol is tumultuous. I know it is arduous. I know that it is very difficult. It's very challenging. But I want to thank you for being willing to show your vulnerability, to err on the side of bravery and courage to keep coming back at this, to keep doing the work on this. I really appreciate it. The resistance wants you to leave. I'm telling you to stay, and you're doing a good job. Thank you, Holly, Duncan, Tony, Kim, and Glynis, all right? I love you, and you're a part of this Strive family. If you want to join Strive, by the way, it's 40 quid a month. A quid, if you don't know what that is a pound, a Great British pound, okay? And if you join up, you'll receive access to all of our coaching programs. That's including the Taster, including the world-renowned Intensive. That's over 100 videos, folks, and it works. You've got a community forum of like-minded people, shared empathy, shared trust that can help you out there. Also, advice and mentorship from our ambassadorial team and our coaching teams. And this week, we're starting to put, we've always had ambassadors. They change and swap and change. At the moment, we have four. We have Craig, we have Stella, we have Laurie, and we have Nikki. Nikki takes care of Australasia. Laurie takes care of North America. And between them, because we're such a fucked up nation, Stella and Craig take care of the UK. Okay, but we also have two coaches at Strive now, Vinnie Grant and John Bell. And if you look through the archives of the Truth of the Alcohol Addiction Podcast, you'll find podcast episodes with both of those. Vinnie Grant is a transformational coach, and John Bell is more on the integrative side of coaching, personal coaching. So if you want to head to the Strive website, thetruthaboutalcohol.co.uk, we've been doing some changes there. You'll see in the navigation bar Strive Coaches. You can check out Vinnie Grant and you can check out John Bell. Two ways to work with them. You can call them up. Their phone numbers will be there. You can work with them personally, or you can join Strive, as I say, the £40 a month membership. And one of them will be doing a weekly coaching call. We had our first one this week. That was Vinnie Grant, and I'll be talking about that at the end of this show, okay? What else did I want to talk to you about? Oh, yeah, on this subscription malarkey. If you pay the 40 quid, you come to the Truth About Alcohol, and you think that what we're doing here is an absolute bag of pants, then just let me know, and I'll give you your money back. And also, you can cancel your £40 at any time you want. If you want to watch the Alcohol Addiction Podcast and not just listen to it, then Google Lee Davey YouTube, and you'll find all our videos there. We're working on a curation site with some of the best podcast episodes, or trying to make it easier for you to find the podcast episodes that relate to you, and we'll slap them on the website when we get around to doing it. And finally, before I go on to this week's podcast, I'm creating a second podcast, okay? So the Alcohol Addiction Podcast, actually, if I could rename this now, I would rename it the Alcohol Podcast. I don't know what I would rename it, but I wouldn't have the addiction part in it. Because I do get a lot of people sending me emails and stuff asking me if they can come on and talk about the opioid epidemic that's sweeping through America and all these different types of stuff. But as we've evolved over the years, I found it's really important to just kind of like narrow down the focus onto alcoholism, or particularly my description of alcoholism, which is that alcoholism is an invisible, violent, and dominant belief system. So it's very alcohol-centric or around the reasons why we drink alcohol, around belief systems, values, relationships, communication skills, that type of thing, right? But it's very alcohol-driven. But what I want to do is create a second podcast. It's going to be called the Strive Podcast. And this is all about inspiration. So if you do take the Truth About Alcohol Intensive over at Strive Community Forum, you'll know that it's split into three modules. Truth, let's understand the truth about alcohol. Awareness, let's raise that truth around us, within our brain cells to create a new belief system around alcoholism. And three, freedom. How do we reassert ourselves into a society that thinks drinking alcohol is the fucking nuts, right? How do we do that? So freedom is all about, to me anyway, it's all about understanding who we are and understanding that actually there are no special people in the world, right? There are no special people in the world. We're all unique. 7.5 billion people are all different. We're all unique. But there are no special people in the world. We all have the capability to do whatever the hell we like. We think about our like biggest star name in the world or whatever. We can be as good as that person if we're willing to do the sacrifice and all that kind of stuff. Physical limitations aside, obviously, if you're 2'4", you're not going to be an NBA star. And if you're 6'8", you're not going to be a jockey. But it doesn't stop you working in those areas if you love them, right? And that's what the Freedom Module is all about, living a fulfilled life. So on the Strive Podcast, I'm going to interview a lot of the people I've interviewed on the Alcohol Addiction Podcast, actually. But instead of talking about alcohol, I'm going to talk about their life. Like David Burns, Feeling Good author. Wouldn't it be good to understand and pick apart how he became, you know, really successful at what he does? Wouldn't it be really fantastic to understand how Melanie Joy became really amazing at what she does? And next week, our first guest will be Bernadette Jiwa. Bernadette Jiwa is a storytelling and marketing expert from Australia. I'm a part of The Right Company, which is a forum that Bernadette runs. Her books are amazing. Her training courses are amazing. And Bernadette knows this, obviously, but she is a real core reason why Striving the Truth for Alcohol feels like it does, right? I love her, and I love her work immensely. She's going to be on the podcast, and we're going to be talking about how she has become a success, right? And we're going to be following the Hero's Journey roadmap, doing that with Bernadette, and that is going to be our new podcast, the Strive Podcast. Okay, right. Let me have a deep breath here and another cup of tea. Right, before we go any further, if you haven't already done so, please go back to the Race Meet Trigger Part 1 podcast, right? There's a hint in the title of this one, because this is called the Race Meet Trigger Part 2, that you really need to watch Part 1 before you watch Part 2, otherwise you won't have a clue what's going on, right? Really won't have a clue what's going on. Do not go forward from this point on if you haven't listened to Part 1. Go back to Part 1, right? Now, I want to start by describing the trigger process at Strive again, okay? So at Strive, we have various different categories where people write in. One of them is called the check-in section, where people write how they're feeling emotionally and what they've been up to on a daily basis. There's a help and guidance category where people can ask for help and guidance or offer help and guidance to other people. But there is a trigger category, and it is the most important category, and it is the most underused category. It's underused because in order to use it effectively, you have to be vulnerable. That means you have to reveal your shame and your guilt, and you have to be courageous and brave. And a lot of people don't want to go there, right? But Kim, who has been a Striver for a long time now, Kim goes there regularly. I would say Kim uses a trigger section more than anybody. And we are going to show you how that actually leads to a really an amazing kind of result. All right. And basically, you're asked a series of prompts in the trigger section related to your trigger. So let's say, let's talk about Kim's trigger. So Kim's trigger was, she was working for a volunteer group. This volunteer group was working at a race meet, and they were manning the bar. So Kim, who has chosen to be someone who doesn't drink alcohol and is at Strive, had to man the bar. So she had to serve alcoholic drinks to people at a race meet. Now, I don't know about you, but the last race meet I went to, I got fucked off my tits. Everybody was smashed. It's who cares about the horse racing, right? It's just all about getting drunk. And here is Kim in the middle of all that, serving this poison to everybody. And obviously she gets triggered, okay? So in part one, we went through that trigger process. Kim went to Strive. She answered the prompts and we went through how I respond and other Strivers and the other ambassadors and peer group members over at Strive respond to try to help Kim make sense of the triggers. So ultimately, she's trying to get to the root cause of why she had a drink. And the prompts help to provide some rational and logical framework for her to, at some point, get to a point where she's able to pinpoint with laser-like accuracy what the actual problem is. In general, it's going to be an emotional problem, and then we can bring in the experts to deal with that emotional issue, all right? So if you listen to part one, you would know that I respond, Kim, I wrote out Kim's trigger, and I responded to it, and now she's responded to my response, okay? So we're going to go through that a little bit, okay? Now, one of the reasons that Kim was drinking, she didn't actually drink at the race meet, by the way. So she was triggered at the race meet, but she didn't drink until a week later. But that was the point where, you know, if you've ever had a trigger, it's generally gradual, isn't it? You think to yourself, oh, I want to have a drink. And then you use some of your tools, or you just get through it by just kind of like willpower. And then the next day you feel it again. And the next day you feel it again. And eventually you just give in, okay? It's more of a gradual process. And this same thing happened to Kim. Okay. Now, one of the reasons why she said she drank is she said that she felt like the odd one out. She felt like the odd one out of the race meet. So I asked her to expand upon this. And this is what Kim said, right? Kim said, I think that I need to accept that I am still holding on to some of the belief that at a social function, if I'm not drinking, I'm the odd one out. And I want to drink to fit in so that the uncomfortable feeling of being the odd one out goes away. Who doesn't relate to that one, right? Yeah. Why do I feel like the odd one out, Kim says? Because I've been conditioned to believe that drinking at a social function is a staple. It's a buffer. I still believe on some level that to not be drinking at a social function where everyone else is drinking is boring and uncomfortable. Okay, that's what Kim said. I'll just rephrase that. I think I need to accept that I'm still holding on to some of the belief that at a social function, if I'm not drinking, I am the odd one out. And I want to drink to fit in so that the uncomfortable feeling of being the odd one out goes away. Why do I feel like the odd one out? Because I've been conditioned to believe that drinking at a social function is a staple. It's a buffer. I still believe on some level that to not drink at a social function where everyone else is drinking is boring and uncomfortable. Okay. So she's drinking alcohol at a social function because she wants to fit in. And as you'll hear me bang on repeatedly for a very, very long time now, and it's going to become a staple part of our philosophy at Strive and True About Alcohol, there's a very big difference, ladies and gentlemen, between fitting in and belonging. Okay, fitting in and belonging. Let me give you a very quick example. My son Jude called me up. No, he sent me a photograph on WhatsApp a couple of days ago, and it was a photograph of an Iron Man arm tattoo and a Wolverine arm tattoo. And my boy said to me, he's 18, Dad, here's the tattoo that I'm thinking of going to have. So think about it. I'm a 44-year-old bloke. My 18-year-old lad, he's sending me a message saying he's going to have a Wolverine tattoo on his arm. Well, you can imagine how I reacted, right? Now, to me, there are three primary reasons why someone's going to have a tattoo. There might be more. One is I'm part of a gang or a social culture. I'm thinking about New Zealand, Maoris, for example, where tattoos are just part and parcel of life. We have to have them. We don't even think about it. It means something symbolic, right, to that tribe. Then there's another reason you have tattoos. Is it symbolic to you? It could be something like your daughter's name or your son's name or your mother or your father passed away. Something really, really super symbolic to you. And then the third one is, it's just plain old ego, right? I want to have a tattoo because I want to take my top off, and when I do, I look really fucking cool, because every time I look at footballers, they look cool. UFC wrestlers look cool. Pop stars look cool. Tattoos are cool, right? But think about that and unpack that. Why is Jude having that Marvel tattoo? Well, it ain't tribal. It ain't symbolic. He's not going to look back at it when he's 70 years of age with pride, is he? And look in the mirror and go, oh, man, you know, Wolverine was my god. Like, I think he's going to be pretty over it by the time he's 90. So the only reason he wants a tattoo, really, is because he wants to look cool and trendy, right? Why? Because he wants to fit in. And if you go down that road of wanting to fit in, and yes, it happens when we were a kid, and yes, it's largely a result of the way that we're parented, the parental styles that are thrust upon us. If you want to fit in, that is very different than feeling like you belong, which is much more about loving yourself, being more comfortable in your own skin, allowing people to see the authentic you, and then to find people and you know, to interact with people, not because you need to fit in, because they're the cool kids, but because you find something that you love about them, right? And this is kind of what's happening with Kim right now at this social function. She wants to wear that tattoo. Her tattoo is this alcohol, I need to drink. And that will come from very early on in Kim's life, where at some point she didn't feel like she fitted in. She felt like she was the odd one out. And when she's in these situations, she goes right back to that old memory, whatever that old memory was. So I just want to make that important distinction there, right? So I responded to Kim. I agree with you, Kim. At social functions where drinking alcohol is the primary objective, you don't fit in because you, Kim, are a striver. And strivers don't belong at these functions. You would also be the odd one out if you went to a rave and you were the only one not on ecstasy, right? Or you was in the rainforest in Peru for an ayahuasca ceremony as the only one not taking the drug. Or you went to a brothel and you didn't fuck someone, right? Or you went to a march to support the vegan movement, right? Because Kim works on a farm, okay? And it's for this reason that Kim doesn't go to raves, she doesn't go to Peru to take ayahuasca, she doesn't go to brothels, and she doesn't go on vegan demonstrations, right? I'm not against putting ourselves in uncomfortable situations, I said to Kim, but not when it threatens our health and wellness. Notice that I didn't say threatens our sobriety, because at the Truth About Alcohol and at Strive, we take the vow to be someone who doesn't drink alcohol. That's a fundamental choice. And that is greater than alcohol. So what I try to teach people and coach people is that it needs to be bigger. Our decisions around alcohol need to be bigger. We need to make a decision that transcends alcohol. And a decision to be healthy and live a well-balanced, wonderful life means that alcohol doesn't fit into that life, right? And I said, for example, I am agnostic, and yet I joined a Christian community in 2018 to experience something different, right? I found periods to be fantastic and times when it was uncomfortable. Like the fantastic times were when everyone was lovely and I felt like I belonged. And then it was really uncomfortable when someone would bust out the Bible and start talking about different parables, right? And talking about God and Jesus and all this type of stuff. It was really uncomfortable to me. Eventually I left because the uncomfortable times, the kind of Jesus, God loves me and the only reason that I do anything good in life is because of God. Those uncomfortable times outweighed the fantastic times, and they were fantastic times, when I felt truly loved and I participated in wonderful events with them. But my alcohol lifestyle, my alcohol-free lifestyle, Lee Davies, someone who doesn't drink alcohol, was never at risk during that Christian community experiment, right? It was never at risk. If it was, I would have just cut myself loose a lot earlier, okay? The reason so many people fail to be someone that doesn't drink alcohol is they're not willing to do the work, I say to Kim, right? And I'm talking about process resistance. So if you ever listen to David Burns talking over at the Feel Good podcast, David Burns talks about two forms of resistance, outcome resistance and process resistance. Outcome resistance being the reason you don't stop drinking is you fucking love it, all right? And process resistance is the reason you don't stop drinking is you don't do the work. Like, you can't take a magic pill, folks. You can't just click your fingers. We don't have a Harry Potter magic wand to shove up your ass. You have to do a lot of work in order for you to be someone that doesn't drink alcohol. Think about James and Janice Traska, Prochaska, who were both like on our podcast a while ago, talking about the five or six stages of change, whatever it is. And one of those stages, the big monumental stage, is maintenance. And they said you go through a maintenance stage for 5 years. 5 years, that is work, ladies and gentlemen, that is work. And I say to Kim, one aspect of the work in boundaries, in I don't know what I'm saying. One aspect of the work, in inverted commas, is setting boundaries around these type of things. I don't go to these functions, right? I don't go. The only exceptions for me to go to a social function where there's booze present is a wedding, a birthday, and a funeral. They're a short supply, okay? All right, I'm getting a little bit older. Some more people are dying. But I am in and out quicker than a teenager having sex for the first time, right? I'm in and out, man. As soon as people start getting drunk and I see it in their faces, I'm fucking gone. So I don't be around that shit. I have strong boundaries around that, right? And this is where the rubber meets the road, I say to Kim. I say, what are you willing to sacrifice to be someone that doesn't drink alcohol? Massive, massive thing now. What are you willing to sacrifice to be someone that doesn't drink alcohol? How aggressive? Doesn't that sound aggressive, right? It does sound aggressive, but it's so much truth slathered all over it, right? You have to sacrifice in order to be someone that doesn't drink alcohol. And every single person who doesn't make it because they haven't made those sacrifices, right? I suggest to Kim that she goes back to her intensive assignments around justification, okay? Around justification. Because what she's doing at the moment in this trigger is she's justifying why she needs to be at these social events. And we cover that in the intensive. I'm not going to go into it here. But justification is one of the strongest weapons that resistance has in order for us to keep the cognitive dissonance at bay and for us to keep drinking, right? Oh, to allow the cognitive dissonance in and for us to drink. So I've asked him to go back and revisit that homework. And then I say to her, you never ever need to be at these events. Ever, ever, ever. Any justification against the notion that you do have to be at these events is merely resistance, right? It's tough, but it boils down to how badly you want this. The longer you avoid these social functions, the stronger your rewiring around alcoholism becomes, right? And by the time that you've really become someone that doesn't drink alcohol because you haven't even been to these things anymore. So you've allowed yourself to avoid triggers and, you know, really kind of rewire these neurological connections that tell you that alcoholism is a really bad thing and only alcoholics suffer it and that alcohol is wonderful and normal and I'll be all right if I drink it as long as I'm not an alcoholic. If you rewire all that bullshit to understand that alcoholism is an invisible, violent and dominant belief system, by the time you're strong enough, like I am today, okay, I can walk into any social function whatsoever and the thought of drinking is enough to make me fucking want to put my head through a wall. It's never going to happen, right? But by the time you get there, Kim, you won't want to go there. So it's really funny, right? It goes full circle. Now it's like, I need to be there because I want to fit in. But when you become someone that doesn't drink alcohol and you're strong enough to be there without drinking, you don't want to go there anyway because you realize this kind of dichotomy between fitting in and belonging. You get it. You've learned it. You understand it. So you don't want to be there because you don't belong there. You don't belong in a rave taking E. You don't belong in Peru taking ayahuasca. You don't belong in an opium den snuffing opium. You don't belong in a brothel having sex with people because you're married, right? So you don't go to those places. You understand that. But you don't understand that about alcohol yet. But you'll get there, okay? Kim says that she ignored the warning signs. So she said there were warning signs building up to working in the bar. So I've asked her, hey, let's just be a little bit more specific here. Are these warning cliff ahead signs or are they warning slow down signs, right? Because a slow down sign is a non-declarative memory. And a non-declarative memory is an automated process. It's like going to an ATM machine and typing in your PIN number without even knowing it. Driving a car. These are non-declarative memories. Well, we'll have the same with alcohol. We'll walk into a bar and we'll think we want to drink. That's a non-declarative memory, right? They exist until they don't exist. And they don't exist after you've done enough of the work. A warning, cliff ahead sign, that's different. That means you're really, really struggling with a craving, okay? So let me say that again. The warning, slow down sign, that is just a non-declarative memory coming kicking in. So who had one this week? I think Craig had one. He's like an ambassador. He was in a situation and he was just, the thought popped in. He said, oh, I used to drink here and it used to be a good experience. Oh, I don't drink. And then he's passed. It's done. There's no issue. He's not thinking like he's going to drink. He didn't have to post on triggers. But a warning cliff ahead sign, okay, that is like, fuck, I used to be here, I used to drink, and I really, 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 really want to drink right now. And cravings start to emerge because you have a desire, okay? If this is the case, then the reason that you're having a craving is because you desire a drink. And the reason that you desire the drink is because you find value in drinking alcohol. And one of the philosophies of our alcoholism theory at the Truth About Alcohol and Strive is that alcohol offers you zero value. And when you realize that alcohol holds zero value and you accept it as part of your belief system, you will not feel the desire to drink alcohol. I believe that. It's hardwired into my marrow and my cells, so I'm never going to want to drink alcohol, okay? Kim, at the moment, she's still not there yet, okay? She still believes alcohol has some value. And as long as she believes alcohol has value, she's only using willpower to get along. Now, there will be people in the world who don't drink alcohol because of willpower, right? My former father-in-law did it with smoking. He didn't read any books. He didn't go into any lessons. He didn't take any nicotine patches. He just said, I'm not going to smoke anymore because my little granddaughter's got asthma. And he just didn't smoke. And he used to say to me all the time, I wish I could smoke. I wish I could smoke. I wish I could smoke. And I was like, fucking hell, that must be driving you mad. But he never did smoke, right? Those people are few and far between. Most people crack. So Kim says, let me explain, she says, I think the warning signs were just non-declarative memories because I hadn't been strongly triggered for a couple of months leading up to this. If I moved through the thoughts and implemented my armory instead of grabbing the thoughts by the tail when they passed through, then I wouldn't have drank in the end. Once again, I panicked because I had cognitive dissonance. I wanted to end the conflict that I had created by being triggered and yo-yoing. So I said, fuck it, and had a drink, right? So there's a couple of things there. What Kim's not doing is she's not using her toolkit. All right. Everybody needs to have a toolkit. If you don't have one, get one, right? We're actually going to work on building one for you at Strive, actually. So when you feel like you have a drink, you need to widen the gap between stimulus and response. Stimulus being I'm triggered, response being I'm going to drink a bottle of vodka, right? We need to widen that gap because the wider that gap becomes, the less likely you are to drink alcohol, okay? Kim didn't do that in this case. She didn't want the cognitive dissonance to come back. She didn't want this internal debate about, oh, I'm a member of Strive and I shouldn't drink. Oh, I really want to fucking drink. Oh, I shouldn't drink, it's poisonous. Oh, I love it. I'm going to get off my tits and numb all my pain, right? She didn't want that fight. But it's really important for a Striver to have this conversation with myself and her peer group and her ambassadors because we know that Kim is obviously feels his value in alcohol, so we can help work on that with it, right? On working in the bar, Kim writes, so in the future, rather than doing what I feel obligated to do, which is help fundraise, I need to protect myself. What goes into my subconscious and be very aware not to put myself in a position where I wouldn't be and wouldn't want to be if I didn't have to help with the fundraising. So she's basically saying, in the future, I'm going to put myself first and I ain't going to work at a bar like this, right? And I think that that is a really good thing, but there's a counterpoint to that as well. So I said, we have to become familiar with feeling uncomfortable. Strive's all about that. We have to become familiar with being uncomfortable, okay? We will grow through these painful periods. So actually being at the bar, serving other people, that in itself or being, that obviously is a problem for Kim. All right, that is a problem for Kim because there's alcohol around. But she can't just avoid these social functions forever and ever and ever. Let's say that she was in a job where she really, really had to be at a social function. It's part of her job and there's alcohol present. She cannot not go there. If someone really close to her died and there was alcohol there, she had to go. If there's a wedding, she has to go. So even though she can leave early at these events, she has to learn to go to these events. You cannot just hide yourself in the bedroom, because if you hide yourself in the bedroom, then all of a sudden life becomes intolerable, becomes boring, you develop agoraphobia, and I get blamed for it, and you think that this, you know, giving up drinking is a load of crap, right? So you have to be uncomfortable. And part of the toolkit is actually surfing your emotions, is surfing your feeling. So a lot of people say things like, oh my God, the addiction was so terrible, I couldn't fucking take it, I thought I was going to explode it, yeah, oh, blah, 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 blah. And generally, when I say to people, well, let's go through this feeling with an intense microscope on it, right? Let's really look at it and really journal how you really are feeling. The whole episode is done in seconds. I liken it to exposure therapy. I heard David Burns once say that he dealt with a young lady who had a fear of lifts, going up and down a lift, right? So how did he deal with that? He put her in a lift. She started having a panic attack. He told her that, you know, he would be with her through the panic attack, and she wouldn't die, and he would be there to help her medically if she had a problem. And then he went up and down the lift, up and down the lift. And eventually she says, can I get out of this lift? And David Byrne's going, well, no, we're trying to kind of cure you here. And she's like, well, I think I'm cured because this is just boring and I'm not afraid at all, right? We over-dramatize our issues, particularly around alcohol, because resistance wants us to over-dramatize them because it wants us to drink. It's part of the deal, right? But it's bullshit. If you really look at this laser-like focus, then the actual trigger, oh my God, I need to have a drink, it's just nothing. It's like uncomfortable. Like being punched in the face, that's painful. Thinking I want a drink of alcohol is not painful, folks, right? We need to put things in perspective. So I just said to Kim, like, imagine in the future you become a novelist and you have to do a reading at a local bookstore, right? Now you're around unfamiliar people, you're in a strange environment. And these are two issues for Kim: unfamiliar people, strange environment. We can't use alcohol to handle that situation. You cannot get drunk when you're going to be in there. You cannot be drinking when you're in there, right? I mean, you can, but you don't want to do that, right? You just want to go in there and experience these people and experience being the novelist in that spot. You cannot use alcohol to use all these different experiences. And I just said, thanks for sharing that you feel isolated and unsupported. Free alcohol-free journey. It's not a nice spot to be in. Happened to me when I stopped drinking, and it did. Nobody understood me. I lost everybody. So I totally get what Kim's coming from. The example, drinking only causes isolation, says Kim. Okay, drinking only causes isolation. I've said a more accurate statement is drinking masks our isolation, and when we stop drinking, we uncover the isolation. So let me tell you that again, because it's important. Kim said drinking only causes isolation, and I've said drinking masks our isolation, and when we stop drinking, we uncover the isolation. So what Kim is saying here is she's drinking at this event and she's drunk at other events because she feels isolated. She feels disconnected. She feels like she doesn't belong. She feels like she needs to fit in. Who feels like that in the world? Raise your hands, right? Who feels like that? They feel different, okay? But what she's doing now, though, is she's understanding and taking responsibility for her actions. She's not blaming anybody else. She's saying, well, actually, when I think about it, although I think drinking helps cure my isolation, I can actually see that drinking causes my isolation. It not only causes her isolation, it allows the isolation to continue. Okay, it breeds it. It gives it energy, all right? What I'm saying is, no. A lot of us always feel isolated, right? We always feel isolated. We've always felt uncomfortable around people. We've always felt disconnected from our society and our people. And we've always felt uncomfortable, all right? But we've never really thought about it, and we've never really challenged it deeply. We never really talked to people about it or philosophized about it because we've used drinking to mask those issues, to get rid of the suffering. So I said to Kim, maybe you could express what your isolation feels like. What does it feel like? Where does it come from? How does it continue to exist on a daily basis? And I've also said to Kim, if you struggle to write out those feelings, create a vlog. Create a little video like I've done now and post it on Strive, which, you know, Strivers do regularly, just to get it out. But I think just saying, I feel isolated, that's why I drink, it's not good enough. We need to know why you're feeling isolated, right? You need to get to the bottom of it. And this is why the trigger category exists. So Kim says, I think my isolation comes from the feeling that I don't fit in. I'm not from the outback, says Kim. I grew up in a large regional town. I moved to the outback when I married my husband, and she was 21 when that happened, right? The lifestyle was and is very different to what I was used to. It took me a long time to get used to it. It was hard work, and there was and still is lots about cattle production that I don't understand. This is stuff that is just ingrained in my husband and the people around me because they've been born and bred into this life. So I think that does contribute to the feelings of isolation. That's what Kim said. So to recap, she's saying that her isolation began when she was 21, when she married her husband, and she ended up moving into her husband's environment, which was very different to her regional, what you call it. She lived in a large regional town, and now she's moving to the outback on a cattle farm, surrounded by cattle farm workers. Okay, it's a little bit like when I stopped working on the railway and when I lived in Ogmore Valley, which was a little mining village of 3,000 people, and I decided to travel around the world with the poker community. It's like moving from an ordinary world into a new special kind of world, right? Which is like part of the hero's journey, which is what we cover in the intensive, okay? But it's very, very challenging for us to adapt to a new environment, because as human beings, we're designed to not need to do that. We're highly adaptable creatures, but we don't want to do it. It's too much effort, too much energy. We just want the same thing to happen every day, because it's easier for us to kind of our brain to deal with everything. So I responded to her and said, "Your writing reminds me of my move when I was 10 years of age, when I moved from England to Wales. Okay. I felt like it was like a completely different world to me. I desperately wanted to fit in. So much so that in my haste of wanting to fit in, I created a monster that I'm still fighting with today. This is why fitting in is so bad. So bad. I became a joker. I messed about. I became the class clown. But I also became very aggressive. I developed a little man syndrome. I defended my Englishness with violence. When people bullied me and called me an English cunt, and people call me a chink. I was violent because my dad taught me to fight with these people, and I would be fighting all the time, right? And I hated it. It was terrifying to go to school sometimes. It was horrendous being the odd one out. And because I wanted so desperately to fit in when I was younger, I've actually created a young lad, Jude, who desperately wants to fit in. And in my relationship with Liza and my friends and stuff, I could be a real pain in the ass, because that little lad, that little 10-year-old, still exists within me, and I still haven't healed him, okay? I still haven't had a little chat with him and sorted that out. So that, to me, is really important to know that, okay? Fitting in is a direct opposite of belonging, and it's a foundation of a fixed mindset, you know, stumbling onto Carol Dweck's work, fixed mindset versus growth mindset. At Strive, we want to attain to have a growth mindset, but I would say 99.9% of people who come, including me, at the core, have a fixed mindset, okay? And a fixed mindset leads to needing to fit in, narcissistic tendencies, ego, all that kind of stuff, right? So at Strive, we want to help people to find true belonging and move into a growth mindset, okay? So, but I think there's so much more for you to unpack here. So what I'm saying to Kim is, yeah, I get it. You moved from a regional town to the outback, which is similar to me moving from England to Wales. Everything's different in the outback, which is similar to everything being different for me in Wales, or everything being different for me when I moved into the poker industry. But I think there's more here. I think the isolation, there's something more. Like, why can't Kim feel like she belongs in the outback? When why can't that happen? There's something else there. So I've asked her to have a think about that. And I've given her another example. I said, I'm in Los Angeles for 6 months. I'll spend 95% of my time with Liza's family, right? Now, Liza's family, when they're together, they speak Korean. But I don't speak Korean, okay? And I'm not familiar with Korean practices and culture, all right? They're also very religious, and I'm not familiar with religious practice and culture, right? You could argue that the two are similar, moving to the outback or, you know, being amongst Koreans, are two very different cultures. You can't argue that. Yet I don't feel isolated here, right? I don't feel disconnected. Because even though I don't know Korean, my mother, my father-in-law, my sisters, my brother-in-laws, my nieces, my nephews, all of Liza's Korean friends, they make me feel like I belong, okay? They see me, they hear me. They're always making me the focal point of attention. They're always asking questions. They're always making me feel comfortable, all right? And I asked him, how does that make you feel? Like, how does that make you feel? And I left her to ponder that, yeah? What else we got here? Let's have a look. take a deep breath, have a cup of tea. I hope this is helpful to you folks. Kim then said, "What I can now see is that I understand this is the nature of drinking alcohol," she says. "When I start drinking, my mind switches off to all the bad stuff, to everything I've learned on Strive, because it doesn't want to be in conflict with the other part of my mind that wants me to drink. To silence the conflict, I have a drink. Then at 3 a.m., it all comes back, and the cycle continues. This is what happened when I started drinking a couple of weeks ago. It was absolutely awful, terrifying, and disgusting, and I want to be out of this cycle forever." And what Kim's talking about there is cognitive dissonance. Okay? The reason that we're able to drink alcohol and not worry about the fact that it killed 3.3 million people, or that it created our infidelity, or that it led to some violence, or it led to me acting like as a terrible role model in front of our children. The way that we're able to do that, and so many people do that in the world, is they have done such a good job, or the conditioning has done such a good job, of not allowing the bad stuff into their mind. So basically, on the seesaw, or if we turn this into, like I talk about it being like the alcohol spectrum, but like let's say it's a seesaw, and at one end of the seesaw is bad connotations towards alcohol, and on the other end of the seesaw is good. As long as the good is, as long as the bad is always the fattest person on the seesaw, we're in trouble, okay? Because we're able to close our eyes to all this bad stuff. A really good example is Melanie Joy's work on carnism. You know, how can we eat lamb when we know that a little lamb is a real little cuddly thing, and likely the person who just ate the lamb has a little pet dog, maybe has a little pet dog that looks a little bit like a lamb, and they love that little dog, and the thought of somebody slaughtering their dog and then chopping it up and frying it and feeding it to them is abhorrent. It is just disgusting. There's a moral issue there. But if you chop up the little lamb, it's okay, right? But think about it. Why is it okay to eat a lamb and it's not okay to eat a little poodle that looks like a lamb, right? Obviously, there's no reason why. But we socially have morals, institutions, we have rules, we have belief systems, we have cultural do's and don'ts, we have taboos, okay? And so we, in order to be able to eat the lamb, we cannot allow that cognitive dissonance in our mind. We have to just cut all that stuff out. And again, the world does a really good system of doing that, you know, like kids' books. So many kids' books have got farmyard animals. So from a very young age, they're seeing that these farmyard animals are beautiful and amazing and wonderful, but you'd never see the slaughterhouses, right? A very unusual parent is gonna sit down to the two-year-old kid. It's hard enough to feed a two-year-old kid as it is. You know, as you're sticking a piece of chicken in their mouth, very few parents are going to tell them that the chicken just lived in a little cage, 4x4, you know? I mean, I do, you know? And then when Zia's old enough, she can make her own decision. But cognitive dissonance is what's going on here for Kim. So when that happens, I've just said to her, why is that happening? Why have you got cognitive dissonance? I want her to think about it. I want her to think, why is this happening? Why am I having this debate? Because I'm asking a question because it will go back to value. It always goes back to cognitive dissonance equals I think alcohol offers me values. On people-pleasing boundaries, I've said to Kim, I think it's a good idea to shift your thinking away from the fundraising and volunteering aspect of the event and place people-pleasing and boundaries through the lens of her personal relationships. I'm sure this is where you'll find more answers. So I'm saying to her, basically, where are you trying to please people in your personal relationships? And what are your boundaries like in your personal relationships? And then we move on to value. And I say, look, I think this is one of your primary issues here, Kim. I said, as an example, Liza's just asked me to go to a Korean restaurant. I'm doing a cleanse, so there'll be nothing for me to eat. However, now I've been asked, the thought of eating Korean food is more value than a long-term feeling of annoyance I will have for breaking my cleanse cycle, right? I also know that once I start eating the food, it's going to taste really good, and that value is going to be stronger than the long-term annoyance. So my reality is I want to eat Korean food and I want to fucking eat it now, right? The cognitive dissonance has entered my head. That means it's only a matter of time before I succumb if I don't change something, right? I said to Kim, you have to accept that drinking has tremendous value for you. Stop pretending that it doesn't. Like, come to terms with that truth and then ask, what now? Okay? I did go and eat Korean food after I phoned them to ask them to make me something that I could eat. And I had to go outside of my comfort zone to do that because I felt uncomfortable, like I was an inconvenience, like I was a pain in the ass, right? And for me, that's a boundary issue that I need to work on. I need to have great pride that I'm a vegan and I need to have strong boundaries. And part of that boundary needs to be, I need to ask them with some assurity, I'm vegan, can you make me something please, right? Same here with the alcohol stuff. Kim's responded with some questions, actually. Why do I have these thoughts and cravings and Lee doesn't? I still believe there is value in alcohol, ? So she's still not sure. My unconscious mind hasn't caught up to my conscious mind yet. I haven't built the muscle I need to move through the urges. Is it all of the above? Like, she's asking those questions because Kim's been working on this for quite a while. Now, it's really important here to note that this trigger of Kim's is something like one drink in episode in like 3 months or something. I mean, Kim will put me right on this. But in terms of how much she's drunk this year, it's minimal. Yeah, it's next to nothing compared to what she used to drink. But obviously at Strive, we want to be 100% someone who doesn't drink alcohol means I don't drink alcohol at all, right? She says Lee David doesn't crave alcohol because he believes there's no value in drinking alcohol. I don't. I don't think there's any value in drinking alcohol. That's why I don't drink. Kim obviously believes there is or she wouldn't have cravings. That's Kim's own words. She said, I'm finding it difficult to answer this because I'm basing it on what I was feeling at the time and not how I'm feeling now, she says. During that last drinking binge, I listened to Annie Grace the whole time I was drinking. I would listen to her during the day and I would drink at night. By the time I got to the last day of listening, I couldn't wait to not drink anymore. I feel like something in me has shifted, she said. I think the overall value has definitely diminished after this experience. However, I still don't want to attend social functions where there is lots of drinking around me. Is this just because it's not engaging? Is it because it's in the evening and I'm tired? Or is it because I simply don't enjoy them? Or is it all of the above? She said, I don't know. Basically, she writes, ah! So, I'm just saying, look, Kim, you're right. I don't drink alcohol at all. Every cell in my body believes this, that alcohol has no value. I'm rarely around alcohol. That's a really important point, right? I hate the stuff. So I deliberately do not want to be around it, right? It's not because I don't want to be around it so I can protect my status as being someone who doesn't drink alcohol, because I don't crave alcohol. But I don't want to be around it. Same as wouldn't want to be around people who shoot up with heroin needles and stuff. It's just not a place I would want to be. I wouldn't want to be around a neo-Nazi rally. Like I wouldn't want to be around a meat march. I just wouldn't feel comfortable, right? It's not what I want to do. I designed my life to be this way. And this is what the Freedom Module is all about. We don't just let life happen to us. We design our life, right? I said, you're drinking alcohol because it has value for you and you'll continue to drink it until it changes. I said, when I went to Johannesburg, I'd never seen so many black people in my life. Like, had I stepped out of the car and my guide wouldn't let me step out of the car, I would have been the only white person there, right? It would have made me feel incredibly uncomfortable, right? Being the only white person surrounded by so many black people, okay? Reading her trigger, I was drawn to this memory in Joburg, and it made me feel sad because I think the world of Kim, right? And it doesn't sound as if enough people has her back, and it makes it... It feels like enough people doesn't have her back to make her feel like she belongs, right? This has to change, in capital letters, if you want to be someone that doesn't drink alcohol. These social events are making you incredibly unhappy. If I was you, what advice would you give me? Probably would be love yourself, right? Put yourself first. Now, I'm a hermit, and that's not ideal, but I know it's my responsibility, okay? If I want to have a zillion friends, then I need to make the effort. Lee Davey needs to make the effort, but I choose not to, and that's on me, right? But it doesn't lead to me being triggered to drink alcohol. If it does, I would be straight out there trying to get friends. But for Kim, it does. So there needs to be something that changes in her life. She needs to create a new life. Now, I'm not saying she needs to dump everybody in her current life and go and get a new life like I did, but she needs to narrow down to the absolute reasons why she's drinking. And I'm pretty sure you would have come to the same conclusion as me after reading this, that it's all around fitting in and belonging and feeling like she's connected. And then thinking how she can change things or change her thinking or change her physiology, so, or change your environment or change your friends, or, you know, and changing your friends doesn't mean ending your friendship. Changing your husband doesn't mean ending your relationship with your husband. Okay. Now, if you can like tailor those things to live a fulfilled life of belonging and happiness, then there is going to be no issue, right? There's going to be no issue. I said people think Strive is about quitting alcohol, but it's not. The most important part of the intensive is the freedom module, but only if the person going through the assignments is taking action. I said to Kim, imagine if you didn't feel the need to fit in. You felt like you belonged. Your diary was always chock full of wonderful things to do that increase your health and wellness. You were in loving relationships. You had fun often. You served and loved the feeling it gave you. Would you drink alcohol? Like fuck would she drink alcohol? She wouldn't drink alcohol if that's how she felt. So are we going to wait until those feelings just magically happen? Or are we going to take control of our life and make changes in order for those things to fit into place? It's not focusing on the alcohol. If you notice this, okay, if we focus on Kim feeling like she belongs and having a fulfilled life, she won't want to drink alcohol. This is very similar to the work that Johan Hari did. If you see his TED Talk, I think it was, he talked about being in Switzerland as a heroin addict and how they legalized heroin use, but nobody, well, very few people use it because they work so much on creating the framework for a fulfilled life. So the reason people, basically the reason people don't take heroin anymore is because it has no value for them anymore. They don't need it, okay? If you lived an absolutely buoyant, beautiful, wonderful life, you wouldn't need to drink alcohol because it would have no value for you, okay? So I said, I think Kim is in these issues at the right time because she's currently going through the Freedom Module in the intensive. I suggested you check in with Nikki, your ambassador, to go through those assignments together, which is something that we have at Strive, which is really important. I said, I will help you every step of the way. And I said, Strive, remember, strivers don't settle for anything but the very best. We put ourselves first so we can be there 100% for those people who need us. And I said, hang in there, you're on the right path. I said, when it comes to balance, this needs to be 100% Kim, 0% everyone else. That sounds a bit kind of drastic, but I'm a great believer that if Kim focuses on herself 100%, then everything's going to be gravy, right? She will be a great mom. She will be a great wife, and her husband will react, and her children will react. She will be a wonderful volunteer, wonderful president if she chooses to go back to do that, wonderful office worker, whatever it is she puts her mind to. If she focuses 100% right now on being someone who doesn't drink alcohol. What else do I put here? A little bit more on fitting in. I've said, Kim, I always thought I was an extreme extrovert until I became someone that doesn't drink alcohol. Then I assumed I was an introvert because I didn't want to be around anybody else. But let's run through a hypothetical. Imagine everyone in the world was our cup of tea. We liked everyone in the world. Would we still display introvert tendencies or would we be more extrovert by nature? If we come to the conclusion that we are an introvert, then what does this mean in terms of the boundaries we have to set and the social structure that we have to create? Every social function that I could attend would revolve around alcohol, but I wouldn't go to any of them. Maybe this is a problem. Maybe the value of drinking alcohol far surpasses the pain of changing life so drastically. So the couple of things I'm talking about there that I want Kim to think about is this extrovert-introvert debate. You know, we're very polarized on that, aren't we? We're very black and white. We always say, I'm an extrovert. Woohoo! I'm an introvert. Ooh. Right? I don't think that's true. Again, I think it's a spectrum. Sometimes we're extroverted, sometimes we're introverts. If you've got a bunch of introverts together, surely, like, if there's 10 introverts all together doing what introverts do, one of them is going to be more extroverted than the other one. Like, or is everyone just going to be like a lot of quiet mouses all the time? I don't think so. I think if you get a lot of introverts together, I think that the most important thing is they feel like they belong. Extroversion a lot of times can just be a mask for fitting in, you know? I can be an extrovert if I want to be, and I can be an introvert when I want to be. But I think my core being is more on the introverted side. But I wouldn't be hosting a podcast, would I? And want to be a live speaker if I was 100% introvert. So I want Kim to think about that. Yeah. I also wanted to think about the value proposition, in as much as the value of drinking alcohol at the moment for Kim, the value of drinking alcohol far greater than the pain of changing her life so drastically. Like, everything I'm asking her to do in order for Kim to be someone that doesn't drink alcohol is massive, massive work. It's massive work, right? It's more value to drink. It's easier to drink, okay? And until that dynamic changes, Kim's going to have a problem. And then boundaries, I just said to her, why don't we simplify this issue around boundaries? And I just put a statement to her. I, Kim, am someone that doesn't drink alcohol. My time is so precious to me. I'm not going to waste it by attending events where I feel uncomfortable to the degree I want to drink alcohol. Right? That's a boundary she could set. Also, I've said to her, she has to come out. She has to come out so she can be you. I remember a good friend of mine rung me once. It was 4 o'clock in the morning, and he said to me, Lee, I'm gay. And I've never told anybody in my life. And I had absolutely no idea. I've been good friends with this guy for 5 or 6 years, and I had absolutely no idea. And he was in his mid-20s. And imagine that. I said to him, knowing absolutely nothing about being gay, the first thing I said was, like, how long have you been gay? And he said, for as long as I can remember. So imagine, for 25 years, or as long as that time span you can remember, being gay, having this sexual orientation that is vastly different to the expectation that everyone around you believes. So everyone is talking to you about, like, he's a bloke, right? So everyone's talking to you about women, about, you know, let's go and do this to girls and that to girls. And look, guess what I did last night with this girl and all this kind of stuff. And asking him questions and talking to him and debating about, you know, male-female sexual relationships. And having to hide that is not what he's about. Like, that, for me, I don't know, it just feels fucking horrendous, you know, and the fact that we exist in a world, and at the moment I'm watching a documentary that my friend created about the Pride rally in Georgia, and I've just been listening to the religious people in Georgia talking about why people shouldn't be allowed to march about gay rights. I mean, the fact that we have these minorities in the world, it's horrendous. And it bothers me because, you know, I was called a chink when I was young because I'm half Chinese. And it bothers me because I'm someone that doesn't drink alcohol, which is also a minority, right? Now, you have to come out, because if you don't come out, you're never going to be you. Nobody's ever going to take you seriously. Nobody's going to understand how to react to you. No one's going to respect your boundaries. Nobody's going to know how to show up for you if you're giving it all, keep it all secret. So I said to Kim, why don't you give yourself a task of recruiting someone to join Strive? Why don't you find someone to join Strive? So you have to tell them you're a part of Strive. You have to be proud of it because you're trying to entice them to come and join Strive. And then you have to be vulnerable because you know this person who you're asking to come on Strive is going to read everything and look at everything that you've written. And when people, you know, write on Strive, they're exposing their innermost, darkest parts of their subconscious that they don't normally talk about. But it's a good thing for her to think about. Kim's last words. At social functions where drinking alcohol is a primary objective, you don't fit in because you're a striver, and strivers don't believe belong at these functions. I agree with this, says Kim. When I read this, it makes me feel very empowered. I've been under a somewhat false belief that if I am someone who doesn't drink alcohol and therefore find no value in alcohol, that I should find no problem in attending social functions where there is lots of alcohol because I can see the con and it shouldn't worry me. But this is inaccurate for many reasons, says Kim. Firstly, I'm not at the stage of this journey where I am 100% sure that I find no value in alcohol, which we've already discovered, right? I am 100% confident I will get there, but I still have work to do, says Kim. I like that because there's a recognition and an honesty there. Secondly, these events make me uncomfortable, says Kim. I don't enjoy them and I feel like the odd one out. There's a potential trigger to drink right there. Putting it simply, the only reason I believed I enjoyed these piss-up events in the past is because I would make sure I was pissed enough to get through them. There was no uncomfortableness because I was always drunk. And now I'm drunk, I see that I don't enjoy them. So let me reiterate your words, says Kim. I am a striver. I don't belong at these functions. I don't attend functions which revolve around alcohol unless it's a wedding, funeral, or a birthday. And birthday, I mean the birthdays of my immediate family. I like that statement. Stick it on your bathroom wall. Fuck that shit, says Kim, because I'm done with people pleasing and being unfair to myself by pressuring myself to attend these sort of events when it's not who I am and it's not what I want. I'm a striver, and that means limiting the exposure to alcohol because the exposure does not serve me and does not support my alcohol-free lifestyle. I am someone who doesn't drink alcohol, and I'm done fucking with that. And what's more, I'm going to shout it from the bloody rooftops. There may come a time when I am so solid that I am someone who doesn't drink alcohol that I can attend any event I want, but that time is not now. Now and into the future, I need to concentrate on my rewiring and setting myself for complete success. As I type this, says Kim, I have never been this solid. I have never felt it in my bones like this. Something has changed within me. I feel like my conviction is strong and that Kim finally has Kim's back. And then she says on isolation, I've been thinking a lot about this one, Lee, and the feeling that I'm isolated because I'm not from the outback, she says. There have been many times in the 20 years I've lived this life that I have tried to fit in, but most of the time I've been working very hard to not fit in. Not realizing what a negative action this is, I think this has been as a self-protection because I have not felt like I truly belong. For the past 10 years, I've been the driving force of a lobby group for equity of access to education for children in the bush. I gave 100% of myself to that cause because I felt true belonging there. Now that I have stepped away from that organization, I am once again faced with a lack of belonging. I believe my lack of belonging is not coming from external forces. So Kim doesn't believe it's coming from a husband, a family, a friend, or a community. She believes it's coming from a lens that she's been looking through. I believe I'm looking through the lens of a 21-year-old new bride. The belief I don't believe is belong is strong, and I think it is cultivated by me, not by anyone else. So she's taking what responsibility, 100% responsibility, that her thoughts around belonging are her thoughts and that she manufactures them, which is really important. There is a lot to unpack here, says Kim, and I think I need to unpack it from within. I have a massive belief that I don't belong based on events that occurred when I was 21 and new to this lifestyle. I continue to look through the lens, which I don't believe is now accurate. Amazing realization. The pros of me holding onto this belief is that I don't have to be vulnerable. I don't have to risk failure or looking like a fool. I can just say, I don't do this or I don't do that, and I can tailor things to how I want them. The cons is a feeling of isolation and not belonging. She says, I'm really starting to feel like all of what I've described is a possibility. And this is where I said to her, imagine you feel like you belong, your diary is always chock full of wonderful things to increase your health and wellness, you're in loving relationships, you have fun, you serve, you love the feeling it gives you. She's starting to feel like this is a possibility. She said, I've started a book club with a group of positive, amazing women that I love spending time with, but I haven't for a number of years because I've been unwilling to make the effort. The book club is an ideal format for us to come together, but the intention behind this idea is that I want to design a social life I want to have and engage with people that love to be around. I feel empowered by this. The days of going to booze events out of obligations are over for this striver. I've talked to my friend about starting an online business together, fashion and accessories mainly online, but also traveling to small towns with a van full of our wares. My drive is to make women feel good about themselves and the skin they're in, and also to do something with my best friend that I'm passionate about. I nearly cried then, because what she's doing is she's taking her biggest pain point. I'm 21 years of age. I'm just about to get married, and which is a massive moment in our life. And I'm going to move to somewhere like and be in a life that I'm not comfortable with. And she knows how that feels and the terror of that. And here she is now talking about creating something that can make people feel better in that situation. I love that. On the point where I said, reading your trigger and drawn to, what did I say to her? I said to her, not enough people have your back to make you feel like you belong. And this has to change if you want to be someone that drinks alcohol, right? Reacting to that, Kim said, you know, Lee, I agree. I haven't had enough people who have had my back. How can I? I haven't been open and honest about my journey, alcohol-free journey. I've flown under the radar. I've not sought the support because I've been unwilling to be vulnerable enough to share my story. How can people have my back if they don't know I need it? I give the impression of being so confident and together when sometimes that is far from what I feel on the inside. I have really opened up to my husband and my daughter in the past few weeks, and it's made a tremendous difference to my well-being and also to the pride of myself for the choices I'm making. I'm consciously extending this to my broader circle, says Kim. It all starts with me and the actions I take. I love that. Being vulnerable is the muscle I believe I need to build right now. Thank you for all you're doing to help me through this, Lee. I feel like everything is coming together, like there is light where there was dark, and that I'm seeing things that I require to ensure I'm someone who doesn't drink alcohol that I've never seen before. The puzzle pieces are coming together. And they are coming together, Kim. Okay? They really are coming together. And next week, there is a part three. Kim said she'd never, ever, ever felt as wonderful and as solid as she does when she wrote that. Well, that was a lie. That was a lie, and you will find out why in part three next week. I hope you enjoyed that. I hope it was beneficial to you. If you've got any questions on that episode, either for me or Kim, then email me at thetruthaboutalcohol@gmail.com. And if you have any questions whatsoever or you just want to reach out and talk to me, then email me again at truthaboutalcohol@gmail.com. Okay? Take care of yourself. Until next week, we'll find out why. What Kim said about never being as solid as she was when she wrote that turned out to be untrue. Thanks for listening. Okay, what next? So if you've listened to this outro before, stop. You don't have to listen to it again. It's going to be a couple of minutes that will waste your life, I guess. But if you haven't listened to this outro before, then please do spend the next couple of minutes listening to it. Don't fast forward me to Tim Ferriss or Sam Harris or someone else, right? What next? You listen to the Alcohol Addiction Podcast. You're learning quite a lot about the truth about alcohol's philosophy, about Stry's philosophy, about how my mind works and how I became someone that doesn't drink alcohol, right? And podcasts will help. They'll help to increase the cognitive dissonance in your mind, right? And not that. What I mean by that is you will start to be questioning whether or not you should be drinking alcohol or not. And that is brilliant. That's great. But the podcast, as essential as they are, will only give you so much. They will only scratch the surface of what your capabilities are or the work that you need to do in order to be someone that doesn't drink alcohol, okay? When I became someone that doesn't drink alcohol in 2009, I quickly set about trying to find the best way of teaching people my experience. Because if you think about it, I had become someone who doesn't drink alcohol very quickly, but then how do you teach people that, okay? It's taken me 10 years, and I'm going to keep getting better and better at it, at cultivating and writing down and expressing my formula, if you like, in what you will see as Strive, okay? And Strive is a family. It's a network of people that have transcended the online realm and are now meeting live and face-to-face, right? Strive is a home where you can feel safe in your vulnerability, knowing that your peers have experienced the same harrowing experiences that you're going through, that the judgment and the shame and the guilt that is poured on you by people who don't understand you doesn't exist, because everybody that you're talking to knows what you're talking about. And I'm talking about building friendships and relationships where you confide in them more than you confide in the person you're married to, or your mum, or your dad, or your kids, or your brothers, or your sisters, or your bestest friends. The depth of conversation and where we go on Strive in the short amount of time is amazing. And it is creating some really strong and some beautiful relationships. In addition to that core support unit, because as I'll always say, we drank alone, we certainly shouldn't try to quit alone. You know, we need that support framework. Aligned to that support framework is our weekly online meetings. So we meet up in Australia, we meet up in North America, we meet up in Europe, and we meet up online and we have a good laugh and we, you know, we seek support if we need it, or we just talk about our day, but we're talking in a safe environment, right? And we're also starting to branch out and meet each other live. We haven't set up any major live events yet. But, you know, only in the last couple of months, I've been to Las Vegas to meet Holly. We had a dinner in Birmingham where six or seven Strivers got together. I know in Australia, Kim and Glynis got together. Stella's been flying around the world, seeing, like, Nikki in New Zealand. And she's been to America and seen Lisa. So that is happening as well, which is super important. We also have over 130 coaching videos, the taster, the intensive, all designed to help you become someone who doesn't drink alcohol whilst being supported by your peer group. But most importantly, a small select band of ambassadors who used to be people who had problems with alcohol, who were kind of stifled and stuck in the quicksand of alcoholism, who came through this process and are now ambassadors, right? They are now helping other people like you to get through these things. And we're going to keep growing. We are going to invite specialists in to help you with your counseling, to help you with your trauma, to help teach you cognitive behavioral therapy techniques. We're going to get people in creating training courses. We're going to have collaborations with other companies. For example, we have a collaboration with Sam Harris and the Waking Up app. So you can, if you join Strive, you get a free 30-day membership of the Waking Up meditations, and money off is lifetime deal. We've got relationship with Nick Littlehales, the sleeping coach, where you can get money off his products to help you sleep better, which is always an issue when you become someone who doesn't drink alcohol. So Strive is growing and growing and growing. It's a monthly subscription. You can quit whenever you like. It costs £40. The way that I measure that up is when I was drinking on a Friday, I would go to the off license and I would buy three bottles of wine for a tenner, right? So if I do that in a month, there you are, I've got myself £40. If I just stop buying those three bottles of wine for a tenner. But if you're anything like me, you're actually spending between £100 and £200 a weekend on alcohol. If you become someone who doesn't drink alcohol, you're going to be saving thousands a year. We're talking about £40 a month. Also, if you find that you're saying to yourself, I don't want to pay £40 a month, it's too much, then you really have to reconsider the priority of being someone who doesn't drink alcohol. Maybe this isn't the right time for you. Because if you want to be someone who doesn't drink alcohol, if you're really serious about it, £40 a month shouldn't be scaring you off, right? And it's important that I say that. I always remember when I joined the Jack Canfield Success Principles coaching course back in 2009. I was £30,000 in debt, and I rung this helpline, and a woman on the other line wanted me to pay something like £2,500 to £3,000, and I didn't have the money. And she said to me, if you can't find the money, £3,000 to change your life, maybe this isn't for you. And I was like, fucking hell, she's right. So I put another £3,000 on top of the £30,000 I had on my credit card. I had £33,000 in debt. And I can tell you within the 12 months, I'd paid all that off. So look at this as an investment. This isn't a doodad, as Robert Kiyosaki says, over Rich Dad, Poor Dad. This is an investment. It is an investment in your education. Because when you become someone that doesn't drink alcohol, Strive isn't about helping you to reach that goal. It's not about helping you to be someone who doesn't drink alcohol. When we become people that doesn't drink alcohol, our biggest challenge is reasserting ourselves back into society. Our biggest challenge is filling our white space with meaning and purpose. Our biggest challenge is finding fulfillment in our relationships and our life. That is what Strive's about. And if you are interested in those things, if you're interested about filling the white space, meaning and purpose, living a wonderful life and achieving your dreams instead of just talking about them, then you need to be in something like this long term. You know, we interviewed James and Janice Prochaska, and they were saying, weren't they, that the phase, maintenance phase that you go through when you're going through recovering from addiction takes anywhere up to 5 years. Please don't take the taste or the intensive or join for a month, stop drinking and think you've nailed it. Hang around for a long time, cultivate these relationships, and most importantly, have a lot of fun. If you're interested in joining Strive, then go to www.thetruthaboutalcohol.co.uk and you can sign up there. Alternatively, you can email me at truthaboutalcohol@gmail.com and I'll answer any questions that you've got. Until then, take care. Thank you, as always, for listening to the Alcohol and Addiction Podcast. And if you want to watch the Alcohol and Addiction Podcast, then Google Lee Davey YouTube and you'll find all the videos for all of our interviews up on the site. Thanks for listening.